Today I'm going to talk about what I call the great food fight. And because it just seems like when you look at anorexia, when you look at bulimia, and then if on that sheet you look at compulsive eating, that pretty well covers a large percentage of the people that are on campus today or just in the United States today have either struggled with at some time or other with some form of what we're looking at today. So it's a very common thing. One thing I wanted to start off with some statistics. 90% of all eating disorder cases reported are female. And generally those things occur at puberty. You don't see much happening before that, but generally after that. And like, for instance, in all the years that I've had, I've only worked with a couple male anorexics, not very many. And I've not worked with any male bulimics at all. So it seems to be, within the female population, it seems to be pretty high. In fact, the day before I left to come here, a sorority gal called me, and she was kind of a chairman of something in her sorority and was wanting to know how, with the, what do you call the new recruits, the pledges, okay. The pledges that were coming in, this was quite a problem, and she just wanted to know how could she handle this problem with the pledges and then refer them, and not saying, you know, you're unpledgeworthy, not to say that you're not pledgeworthy or all this other kind of stuff. How can we help you through this type of situation? I thought, well, that's good that a sorority is actually looking at and realistically considering the fact that somebody may have this problem coming in and that we're not going to reject them. Last year, I was counseling with a young woman who was actually kicked out of her sorority because they discovered that she had an eating disorder. So they actually kicked her out of the sorority, which was kind of interesting because about 60 to 70% of the girls in that sorority have eating disorder problems. So it's kind of like we found somebody and they crucified her and sent her off her way, and maybe they felt better doing that. I don't know what happened, but anyway, it was a pretty hefty thing with that particular sorority. Anorexia has about a 22% mortality rate, and so it is quite a life and death matter for that. For every one anorexic reported case, there are 12 bulimic cases. That's approximately, and a lot of cases go unreported. A lot of the cases that I work with aren't actually reported statistically, and so I do know that there are a lot of that. 60% of all models and dancers have eating disorders. So if you happen to be in that particular field, you might want to watch out for that one. And, of course, it's wherever there's real pressure for what I'll call body conformity, when your body has to be a certain size or shape or something, that has a tendency to spurn a eating disorder. And that is a person that actually becomes so focused in. So what I want to do now is kind of give you a description. What this little sheet is here is just one of those things you can kind of go through, and what are just some general checklists to determine if perhaps I'm either borderline or getting there with a particular eating disorder. Like the first one, you know, anorexic nervosa is the one that generally came out in prominence first. It actually literally means a nervous lack of appetite, which is a misnomer. It's not really a nervous lack of appetite, but it's been dubbed anorexia nervosa, you know, and so it's not really that, but that's what the name is, so it's really a misnomer. And it's characterized by weight and food preoccupation. People get preoccupied with it, and there's just intense desire to be thin, and we're going to be looking at some of the emotional factors of why that is. But the major feature then that distinguishes persons with anorexia from other dieters is that distortion of their body image. Most anorexics don't quite understand, you know, they just a little bit thinner is better. Now, if they weigh 90 pounds, just a little bit thinner is better. And if they weigh 88 pounds, just a little bit thinner is better. I mean, even if they're, you know, 5'6", it doesn't make rational sense, but to them, there's a real body distortion. They see themselves as fat, even at that case. In an attempt to control their weight then, these persons starve themselves, and they may become involved in compulsive exercising. one young woman I was counseling with said, you know, hey man, I'm over my eating disorder now, and you know, it's great. And this was up in Nebraska. I said, oh, well, that's good. And I said, but you look kind of peaked. What's the deal? And she said, oh, you know, I'm running 6 miles every morning. I was going, okay, why don't you stop doing that? You know, it looks like you could use a little rest. And she said, well, I can't stop doing that. Well, she had just substituted her eating disorder and then become a compulsive runner, if you will. And so she began doing that. The loss of weight becomes so rewarding that a person with anorexia then becomes even more relentless in their pursuit of thinness. Another young lady said that she, one morning, she stood on the scale and she looked down. This was when she was in high school, and she looked down and she'd lost 2 pounds. And she said everything in her life had been totally, up until that point, had been totally... She'd failed at everything. You know, she was trying to be a dancer, and the folks weren't happy with that. And she tried to do this, and her grades weren't always the best. You know, she'd gotten a B once or something. And, you know, a straight-A student, but she got a few Bs, and, you know, although that's terrible, and, you know, some people have those. I never had that problem, by the way. And, you know, she looked down, and but she looked down there, and 2 pounds. She'd lost 2 pounds. And she said it was like, something inside of me snapped. It says, I am a success. I lost 2 pounds, and I did it. And so she felt good about herself for the first time that she could remember. And so guess what happened with her? How are you going to feel good about yourself next week? Lose 2 more pounds. Yeah, that's great. And she got hooked on a feeling, if you will, of being successful in losing weight. And it just became a habit for her. She began doing that more and more and more. So it was so rewarding that she even became more relentless in her pursuit. You know, that for her, it was just that tangible. Now, it can be rewarding in that your body size reduces. And sometimes that makes you more attractive, or guys or gals, depending on which, whatever the case may be, become more interested. Type of a thing. And so there can be those kinds of rewards coming on, which are more emotional, relational types of rewards. And the self-starvation continues then. These persons develop chronic illnesses due to impaired immune systems. Some may eventually die. We talked about 22% as a result of the complications of that syndrome. And about half, 50%, develop bulimic tendencies within 2 years of the onset of anorexia. A lot of anorexics will move over into bulimia, and then some will have a combination of both. They'll do anorexia, bulimia types of things, going back and forth in that. This young woman I was talking about earlier from Nebraska, she'd actually got to a point of the compulsive exerciser. She was exercising, but an interesting phenomenon began happening, that the roof of her mouth started peeling away. And she had come to that point in starving herself with almost like a scurvy lack of vitamin C condition. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with when some of the pilgrims came over. They used to, before they did this, or before they started packing fruit with them, they'd come over from the Europe to America for the very first time, and they had this interesting phenomena. They'd say scars that they would have would reopen again. You know, old scars. Well, see, vitamin C keeps our scar tissue together. And so anyway, sometimes you'll see they can get that severe where you'll actually see almost a scurvy-like condition where, you know, things start falling apart, basically, and it's not good. Okay, that's anorexia nervosa. And see, on this sheet there are some common things that as you go through the checklist, you may just want to read through those. You know, this is for women, do you have irregular periods, or have you experienced total loss of menstruation? Have you been dieting, not because you're overweight, according to the standards based on your age, sex, or height, but because you desire to be more slim in your appearance? And do you claim to feel fat when others tell you obviously are not overweight? And you can read just as well as I can, so you can read through those things and began seeing that. So that might be helpful as you examine not only yourself, but go in with friends so forth. And you know, it's interesting. How do some people even learn about how to do that? I'm kind of torn between two things. You know, I think education, I know education's good, because I mean, I've been involved in it for years, and it seems like I've been a student forever almost. But yet, more and more, it's been interesting. Some of the gals that I've counseled with, and some of the guys, I'll say, well, where did you learn this? How did you learn about this in the first place? And they say, well, I read an article about it. So it's kind of like they read this article and it says how to be a bulimic. I mean, you know, they actually said, oh, that's a neat idea. I hadn't thought about that before. And then they start doing it. So I've kind of got mixed emotions, because the number of people I've counseled with maybe wouldn't have got the idea if they hadn't read about it. But then they read about it and they think, now that's a good idea. I hadn't thought about that. Laxatives. Oh yeah, I could do that. You know. And they do. And so, you know, I've kind of got mixed emotions there. But we can actually teach people how to do those things the more we educate them. And that's not the intent of the class today, by the way, to educate you that way. Bulimia nervosa literally means ox hunger. I've got the hunger of an ox. And when you only have the binge part, then that's called compulsive overeating. So that's what we're going to be dealing with next. But this bulimia then is more of a binge purge cycle, where you eat a lot and then you purge it, either through, we'll talk about those different things. It's characterized then by compulsively eating large quantities of food and purging the food from the body by means of forced vomiting, laxative abuse, and diuretic abuse. At times, compulsive exercising or fasting may be used to compensate for an eating binge. So that's kind of going a little to the anorexic side. Bulimia is supported by convoluted, twisted, and confused emotional reactions to a dysfunctional type of relationship with one or both parents. And that's where you kind of come into the social, the familial aspect, the family aspect of it. And generally you'll see that as you counsel. There's something going on in the family structure that is causing a person to react this way, and it manifests itself out in an eating disorder. In this case, bulimia. Persons who develop this order are predominantly adolescent and young adult women, many of whom were previously overweight. However, persons with bulimia may be underweight, overweight, or average weight. So there's no way of telling by looking at a person whether they're bulimic or not, because they can be that. Like persons with anorexia, those who suffer from bulimia are also obsessively preoccupied with the thinness, with the food, with the body size, and this preoccupation gives way to periods in which they may feel out of control in their consumption of hundreds or thousands of calories during single eating binges. So, you know, one of those binges, some people can consume up to 5, 6, 7 to 10,000 calories in one sitting, which is a little bit more than the body requires. My master's degree at the University of Nebraska was in monogastric nutrition, so I do know a little bit about the body requirements as far as nutritionally goes, and that is a little bit too much. At some point, the bulimics will be overwhelmed with feelings of guilt, you know, so they do this binging, and then they feel really, really guilty, and they'll seek to relieve this guilt then through purging behaviors, and the purging cleansing, if you will, is another way of saying that. However, because these behaviors are compulsive, now let me stop here and define compulsive just for a second. A compulsive behavior, if you look at, I'll talk about is the elements of the personality. If you look at, you study personality theory revolve around three elements of personality: mind or intellect, synonyms. Emotions or feelings, and will or your volition or your choosing. So your thinker, feeler, and chooser, if you will. If you study all personality theory, it'll be a combination of those three elements. So you get rational emotive theory, for instance, is mind and emotion, the effects of the mind on the emotions, those kinds of things. Behavioral modification is just will types of things. So when they talk about compulsive behavior then, compulsive behavior And this is any compulsive behavior, by the way, whether it's addiction to pornography or sex or eating disorder or whatever it is. Compulsive behavior has its basis that a person loses the ability to choose. So in their rationale then, in their intellect, they've maybe battled against the problem so long that they finally come to believe that they can't choose against it. And when they believe that they can't choose against it, guess what happens? They can't choose against it. So if you feel like binging and purging, they just binge and purge. And it's like something comes in and takes over. And you find, one person described it to me this way, it was like, my mind said, do not eat that. My hand reached for it and stuffed it in my mouth. And that's really what it's like. It's like you're almost an automaton, you know. You're just kind of controlled by some software someplace, and you really have no control over that. But that's what compulsion is. A compulsion is losing the ability to choose, or at least the belief that you can't choose against something. Okay. But because their behaviors then are compulsive, persons with bulimia nervosa find themselves locked into this binge-purge cycle, leading secret lives which result in feelings of guilt, depression, shame, alienation, and fear of discovery. So one of the things you'll see, it's really hard to get things going with a bulimic or anorexic for that matter, because they have the same thing, because they're not wanting, you know, if we had said today was going to be a class on eating disorders, and it was open to the whole campus, we'd probably, and it wasn't a required class like this one here, you probably wouldn't have very many people show up that are actually anorexic bulimic. You might have a few, and those would be the desperate ones. But someone who's toying with it wouldn't generally show up because it'd be secretive, because if I showed up, then that would mean that somebody would know that I might be struggling with that problem type of a thing. So they have a tendency to try to stay away from those things. And one of the things that you'll see, one of the reactions you'll see when you talk to somebody that you think may have an eating disorder and you're just concerned about them, is they generally explode. They don't like it because you're getting too close to my secret. And so you'll see some kind of reaction and they'll begin to withdraw from you and pull away. And that's just a normal thing. And by the way, if you're trying to help somebody with that, don't withdraw and pull away. Just hang with them and love them and be available to them. Okay, then the physical consequences of this order are numerous, including damage to the teeth, to the gums, to the esophagus. I had never had this before. I had a young gal last year come in, and she said almost with a pride. I mean, the way she said it was actually with a smile. It was almost pridefully, but it was really hard for me to determine. But she said that she had gotten so good at bulimia that all she had to do was to bend over, and she could dump her stomach just by bending over. So she had to be careful about bending down to pick up books and stuff like that, you know, or she dropped her pen on the floor, you know, you go down like this and stand back up. But she had become, so I bet she was saying it in such a way that it was like, boy, you know, I'm really good at this. I said, great. Whatever you do, stay upright in my office, please. But then you see, as a result, the stomach acid, see, is what happens. Is a, you know, the hydrochloric acid in your stomach is not, you know, hydrochloric acid, for some of you that are in chemistry, is, you know, it dissolves meat, digests meat. And so when you throw this stuff up, it gets in their mouth and their teeth and their gums, and it starts eating that stuff away. And then it also does that to their esophagus. So it's not really a good deal for your digestive tract. Then that can also affect the kidneys, the lungs, and the heart. And death sometimes results from complications and from those symptoms, or from just finally they get so caught in the binge-purge cycle that they just check out, commit suicide. They just don't want to mess with it anymore. Compulsive overeating then, I want to look at, is characterized by intake of large quantities of food. There's a part in there, in your sheet here, and this is probably the most common one. This affects both men and women alike. in a large percentage of the male population. Compulsive overeating is characterized by intake of large quantities of food, usually without purging that. They're not purging it. It resembles a bulimic-like binging or grazing. I like that term, grazing, over periods of hours with the intent of escaping or anesthetizing feelings of anger, inadequacy, humiliation, fear, loneliness, boredom, or other unwelcomed emotions. And this includes eating for pleasurable reasons rather than for nutritional type reasons. So it's kind of eating for pleasure, if you will. I kind of like that term grazing because it's just kind of this mindless grazing. You know, you're talking to somebody and you're stuffing. Yeah, I mean, I'm a compulsive overeater. Okay, you probably figured that out. But, you know, and so I have a tendency, it's real easy if I'm talking to someone and doing something and there's some chips in front of me or anything else, it's just like you do not stop until it's all gone. You know, and I just keep, and it's a mindless thing. You just keep doing it, keep doing it, keep doing it. And we'll talk about some of the emotional reasons why that happens, and I can be sharing from experience on those. Compulsive overeating, then, if you're looking at kind of the stages of the development of compulsive overeating, the first stage involves eating then for that pleasurable reasons. You know, let's have a party, let's order those pizzas because it's fun to eat, even though we've had supper and we've already had our caloric intake for the day and we've had all that we need. Let's just eat for fun. And let's, or drink for fun, whatever it is, rather than for nutritional sakes. And many persons in our culture operate from this. Compulsive overeaters, again, may not be necessarily, you generally can't tell by body size or shape with them. You know, one of my roommates in college, he always made me mad because he was a, you know, there's a term for guys like him, it's called gluttons, okay? And, you know, he could consume thousands of calories a day, and he was as skinny as a rail. I mean, I could never understand that, but I don't know where all that food went. But it definitely didn't go into muscle and or fat, you know, in his body. He was as skinny as, still is as skinny as a rail, even though he's in his 30s now. But I could never quite understand, I couldn't eat near what he ate. And that always made me angry that God gave me such an efficient body. You know, that's what I say. If the food resources in this world dried up, I'd be one of the last ones to go. You know, because it doesn't require very much for my body to do that. Anyway, like you say, what is it? A moment on the lips, forever on the hips type of a thing. Yeah. And so I'm very efficient. The second stage, then, is characterized by problem eating. These persons in this stage eat for emotional reasons. When they're sad, they're happy, they're bored, they're nervous, they're depressed, you know. They're sad. Something happened. They just broke up with a boyfriend or girlfriend. And what do I do? Well, let's go to the fridge and see. You know, I'm gonna have some pleasure, give myself some pleasure. Got an A on that test. What should we do? Well, let's go down to, get a, what do we call those? Those things we had yesterday for lunch, John? Calzone, yeah, let's go get one of those puppies and chomp a couple of those down or something to celebrate, you know. Well, I'm bored. What shall we do? Well, let's eat. Yeah, that's a good idea. Whatever they are, or nervous, you know, studying for a test or whatever it is. So they're eating then for emotional reasons. That's the second stage. And they may lie about how much they've eaten, steal food, or hide their eating in secretive ways. So then, generally, with a compulsive overeater, you'll begin to see that their mind begins to think about future meals. You know, this is what I have for breakfast. I wonder what I'm going to have for lunch, you know, or where are we going to eat for lunch. Let's plan out our menu for the next week. Menu planning, by the way, is good. I'm not saying that, but sometimes they get so focused on just what the next meal is going to be. They're really looking forward to it. Then the final stage in the compulsive overeating is a person just loses control over their decisions about food, totally. And abuse and refined they begin to use refined carbohydrates quite a bit, like donuts, sweetbreads, cakes, chocolate, sugar. Of course, none of you have ever struggled with that. Compulsive overeaters then may become addicted to one or more specific kind of foods and consume vast amounts of them daily to the exclusion of eating nutritionally. Their lives are truly out of control, resulting in guilt, anxiety, hopelessness, and depression. Compulsive overeaters typically have tried every diet imaginable. You know, which was kind of interesting for me, because since my master's degree was in monogastric nutrition, I had the technical know-how. And so whenever a diet came along, I could analyze it from a nutritional point of view. And so but that didn't make any difference, to be honest with you, because we're not dealing with a rational issue, we're dealing with an emotional issue. And so so I've tried every diet imaginable, only to regain. Somebody said, how much weight have you lost? Well, I think I've lost about 2,000 pounds, you know, over the course of the last 15 years. So, but then they say, how much have you gained? Well, it's 2010, you know, is what I've gained. So, so I'm a positive 10 at this point. But anyway, this cyclic fluctuation of body weight may have complicated their body's natural metabolism, so that weight loss maintenance is difficult. Which basically all that means is you can train your body to get along on less, or you can affect the metabolism of your body by the way that you eat. And so if you eat incorrectly, you can affect your natural metabolism, which may actually result in the inability to lose weight. Okay, that's really good news, isn't it? Okay, the physical consequences of compulsive overeating include diabetes with a high incidence of sugar. Your pancreas then, which secretes the insulin, gets overworked, and then until it finally burns out. And when it burns out, then that's called diabetes, and you have to start taking insulin injection. And many people, just before that, then they'll have what's called hypoglycemia, low blood sugar, and that's when the cutoff point in your the pancreas actually secretes too much insulin for the amount of sugar that's in the body or that's in your digestive tract, and so it pulls the sugar out of your bloodstream, and your brain, instead of functioning on 110, is functioning on 9 volts instead of 110, and so then it's got some emotional results. So that's low blood sugar. It can also result high blood pressure, gallstones, cancer, arthritic complications, number of different things can occur with just compulsive overeating. In summary then, eating disorders are serious conditions, and treatments must involve more than just willpower. Trying the newest diet on the market or forcing a thin person to eat, you know, just to say, well, somebody will stop eating that, or why don't you just eat more, or some of those simplistic types of things don't work. It'd be nice if they did, but they don't tend to do that. And even if a person gets to the point where they need to be hospitalized, and I don't know what the name of the place here, there's inpatient treatment, what's it called, Great?
Charter Plain,
yeah. That's what I've heard a number of people have gone to. Go to something like that, then, you know, if they're not cautious, if they're not working with a dietitian and so forth and so on, and then have some follow-up things, it can just be a temporary fix, if you will, for a more permanent problem. And research now indicates then that this disorders, and I think this where it really ties in with, if I understand what you're studying here in this class, indicates that these disorders most likely result from a combination of biological, psychological, cultural, and familial issues. So it's a combination of those four issues. Now let me give you an example of that, if I can find it here. Okay, here, biological, for instance. Eating disorders create habitual patterns of eating which are detrimental then to your health. And those habit patterns, if you're dealing with that with an eating disorder, you've got to break those habit patterns somehow. And so instead of just dealing, you know, so you're going to have to deal with them and appropriate, like for instance, appropriate portions of food. What's natural for a person to consume with your body shape, size, and your metabolism? You know, what diet actually does that? Well, very few actually do that. They try to teach you just the appropriate portions. I would tend to say stay away from groups that would have you eat special foods. And the reason is because you, I don't know about you, but sometimes you go out to eat and you don't carry your special foods with you. So, you know, there are some systems that all they have you do is eat their food that are specially prepared in their ways and so forth and so on. And I would say not necessarily to, you know, that you have to go, but if you're trying to break a cycle, you need to learn to eat normal foods in normal proportions. And so that's just dealing with the physiological. So there's a habit pattern that needs to be broken there. So a dietitian is helpful at that point to come in. Now the psychological, we'll look at this a little bit more detail. But psychological then, most specialists in the field would agree that eating disorder individuals need outside help. You know, they can't do it themselves. And since most of the basic causes are emotional in nature, which then affects the rational, it's necessary for the person to get some rational and emotional help. In other words, mind and intellect both need to be worked with in this. It's generally not an individualist venture, something I can do myself. Most eating disorder people wish it were, because they don't want to trust other people. They don't want to let them in on their secret. They don't want to be dependent on anybody else. That's in their mindset. And so, they do need an objective opinion, and they also need encouragement from other people. So it is a psychological factors can be coming in there, and we're going to pull that one out and look at it in just a minute here. And then the cultural one, you know, continual pressure can be felt from well-meaning yet misinformed individuals. You know, you look way too thin. Why aren't you eating more? You know, and when somebody comes up to a ED person, eating disorder person, and when they say those kinds of things, what it really does is it refocuses their attention back on their eating disorder. So they actually become culprits in the whole thing. And they can actually begin to, focus them back on their body shape, their size, the food, what they're eating, what they're not eating, which is what you're trying to pull away from in the first place, getting your focus off of those things. For instance, if I were to say to you, now, I want you all just for a minute to think about pink rabbits, okay? Now, the first one of you that forgets about pink rabbits, I want you to raise your hand. Well, the first time somebody raised your hand, I'd say, okay, now what was it you're supposed to forget? And if you didn't remember, then you truly had it. And then I would say, well, why'd you raise your hand then? You know. But see, so it's really hard to forget something we're focused on. And so continually doing that. So, you know, it's really hard to break a habit that you're continually focusing all your life on. And so there's that kind of thing that basically enters in. Then cultural also is the media and advertising pressure. You think there's some media and advertising pressure out there about body shape, size, conformity? I think so. You know, how can you rush for the border without keeping your own border from expanding too much? So that's the problem that I have many times. I do want to rush to the border, but then I have to let out my belt one more notch after I get finished rushing for the border. And then the familial or the family relationship. Sometimes this can be the hardest aspect of all to begin to try to... It's indeed very difficult to change the way you relate to your family. In fact, John and I were talking on the way over here about... They're interesting, probably something you're studying, I don't know, but that transition from adolescent to adult. And there's a tendency within parents to want to keep you as an adolescent. And there's a tendency for you as a child to want to keep your parent a parent. And as you begin to move through the system, there comes a time when you're almost, you should be able to relate to each other as individuals. Mutual respect, differing opinions, so forth and so on, which actually makes the relationship stronger. But I was counseling a young woman, and she said, I really feel bad. And I said, what's the deal? And she said, I'm angry at my father. And because she had an eating disorder, and he basically said, well, get over it. Get your act together. You're causing your mom so much stress. And she said, man, I'm really angry at him. And I said, well, good. You need to be. And she kind of sat back in her chair and said, "What?" I said, "Yeah, you need to be."
I don't think that's really appropriate. Or I think it's appropriate that you feel that way.
And because, see, you're making this transition now. You're beginning to move. Now you're realizing that your dad isn't perfect. And that he doesn't have to be perfect. Your expectations aren't that he's perfect anymore. And you can be angry with him, but you can forgive him. You can realize he's a different, he's an individual too. And he as a dad makes mistakes, doesn't he? Yeah, okay. Well, then you can begin to cut him some slack, just like you cut other people some slack. You don't have all those high expectations. You begin to relate to him as an individual. You know, you're moving in that direction, but you don't know how to do that yet. And he doesn't know how to do that yet either for you. And so that can be a real positive sign there. So if your relationship to them, and you've heard this word many times, codependent, probably maybe overused word, or enmeshed with your family in an unhealthy relationship, then continual contact with your family can renew the hurt and the emotional trauma which may have caused the eating disorder in the first place or been causative in it. So you also, so any one of these issues, if you don't deal with the physical habits, if you don't deal with the psychological, with those situations, if you don't deal with the culture and way, if I'm going to look at TV, if I'm going to go to those movies and see all these, you know, actresses and their shapes and sizes and all this kind of stuff, how am I going to deal with those kinds of things? And then if you don't deal with family issues and working at foursome in all those, and there are more issues than just those four, if you don't work on the four fronts of a battlefield, then you're probably not going to affect really, you know, change for a permanent basis type of thing. So you've got to deal with it on all four levels. What time does this class get over? Is it 1:30? 12:20 or 12:15? Okay.
They don't have to say
it
the whole time, but whatever time.
Yeah.
That's not against you.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
That comes regularly,
huh?
A daily response.
Okay. Well, here's what I'm just going to point out a few truths about eating disorders, which are generally mistaken. I used to say these in the negative, but I'm going to state them in the positive this time, okay? So there are truths about eating disorders. One is it takes more energy to not change than to change. Most individuals in eating disorders believe that it takes more energy to get out of it than to stay in it. But in fact, it's the opposite. It actually takes more energy to stay in than to get out. And so that's just one of the things that through the years has really come to most people that have been in it have realized to maintain that kind of lifestyle is just too hard. To maintain the secrecy, to be isolated from other relationships, to, you know, continually go on and on, have the health problems and everything else, it actually is harder. And just facing it, confronting it, getting the help and getting out. Even though that can be a very painful and emotional time. Truth number two is it takes help and encouragement from others to change. I need other people, and we talked about that. Truth number three is my friends will care for me even if I don't have a problem. Some people have come to believe that if they don't have this problem, that their friends probably won't pay them any attention. And so then they have a head of hesitancy to get out of it. And then also with that, not a different one, sometimes my identity becomes so wrapped up in being an ED person, eating disorder person, that it's hard to let go of the identity. You know, I can begin leading groups in support groups for eating disorders, and the next thing you know, their total identity is wrapped up in eating disorders, and that becomes their identity. And that becomes their focus. And that's who I am. Who are you? I'm a bulimic, you know, or ex-bulimic or whatever, you know. Say, well, okay. So there's a tendency for identities to get wrapped up there. Truth number four, we talked about compulsive behavior. The truth is I can choose to stop this defeating lifestyle. You know, now I need help from other people. Again, you got to keep it in correlation with the rest of it. Truth number five, I don't need an excuse to make mistakes or fail in life. You know, I can make mistakes and I can fail, and it's okay. Most eating disorder people are trying to be perfect, be perfectionists, and have no failure in their life. What's really interesting is their life is characterized by failure, most generally. Because the thing that they go to control their weight, to control their life, is they're totally out of control in. They're just totally out of control. Okay? And then the sixth thing is I can choose against what I feel without damaging myself. There's something interesting about college students, about the American culture in general. They think that if you choose against your feelings, you'll damage yourself. Right? So if I, you know, so if I think it's right to do something, but then I don't feel like doing, I better wait until my feelings come in line, and then I can do it. Because if I go ahead and do it without it, then it doesn't have any meaning, doesn't have any purpose, and it's probably going to be damaging to that other person and to myself. Now, it's 10 minutes to 12, and at about 11 o'clock, how many of you felt like going to class today? Say, now, not an over-response of hands here, but saying that's just it. That's the point is. We choose against our feelings all the time. When I was a college student, one time at Iowa State, I went to Iowa State University for 3 years. On finals week, I had a final every morning at 7:30, Monday through Friday. And then on Friday, I had one at 9:30 also. So I had 7:30 to 9:30 and 9:30 to 11:30. So that was my final schedule for that time, which, by the way, I overslept on Friday and missed half of my first final. So anyway, I was so tired staying up all night studying all week. But, you know, I did not feel like getting up and taking my finals, especially after Wednesday. You know, it just seemed like I was tired. And so I chose against my emotions, and of course it did not damage me. It actually helped me out quite a bit, kept me from failing. Some eating disorder focuses then is food. That's common. Feelings become a focus. Fatalism. I didn't mean all those to be F, but I guess they are. Food, feelings, and fatalism. Fatalism is it'll just happen again. You know, there's nothing I can do. Body, then the conformity, which basically equals acceptance. You know, I get acceptance by my shape or size. And then a habit, I can choose against it. That's the focus is the habit. Perfection can be a focus. Secrecy can become a focus. And also just childhood memories can become focuses, some of the things that are causative and some of the relational things. So where can an individual go for help? But before you answer the question, or before I answer that question, I must ask a couple questions. One is, do I really want or need help? And am I ready to receive help? Now this, you remember the young lady I talked about that could just bend over and empty her stomach? She was also seeing a psychiatrist, and when she came in to see me, which, you know, you always question, why are you coming in to see me if you're seeing a psychiatrist? But as she came in to see me, she said, I'm paying $400 an hour for this psychiatrist. He was one of the most prominent in this particular city. It wasn't in our city. And I said, so why don't you see, you know, what's the deal? And she just had stopped seeing him, and she was not seeing me. And I said, why'd you stop seeing him? He says, well, he was too direct. I said, listen, if I'm paying a guy $400 an hour, I want him to be direct. You know, that's what I would think, at least. But anyway, she had come to a point where she maybe was not really willing to get help at that point. If this guy was just telling her the truth and being direct to her, because she's paying him enough, then and she's offended at that and she leaves, well then I think she's not quite ready yet to that. So if you're seeking help, or if you're seeking help is conditional, you're probably not ready yet. You know, if I throw a life preserver to a to somebody that's in the ocean and they look at it and says, that's not my color. You know, color me beautiful. I'm more the mauve person or whatever. And you say, I don't think you're quite ready yet for this. But what if you know someone with an eating disorder? Well, you may volunteer to go with them or to encourage them to get help. They do need help. But be careful then not to take responsibility for it. And, you know, it's I can try to get my deepest emotional needs from this piece of pizza. But, I mean, when we just think about it for a second, that's pretty irrational. That I would look at a body provision, food, to try to meet a deep emotional need. Maybe for love, well, we're going to look at what those are, but one of them is for love and acceptance. You know, food does not reject me. So I look to it for this emotional need for love and acceptance. And so that's perhaps the most common emotional need that a person uses, or they're trying to get through this eating disorder. That's one of them. There's about four or five. And so they're trying to get that love and acceptance through body conformity, through the body size and shape, which can be a cultural thing again. Or you may have been raised in a home where food equals love. See, now again, I was born in a farming community in northwest Iowa. My parents were farmers, of course, and they were not well-to-do farmers. They were struggling farmers. The difference between a farmer and a rancher is a farmer has crops and a rancher generally raises cattle or something like that. So anyway, we were crop farmers. And but as a result, though, we had a few cows and stuff, and we had plenty of food. So mom, if she's going to do something special for you, she really couldn't do clothes or cars or that kind of stuff, but what she would do is to bake your favorite thing. By the way, I still get it when I go home. It's like, you know, here's your favorite gooey, sticky cinnamon rolls that you always like. And then I'm going, but Mom, I'm on Weight Watchers. You know, that does not fit into my diet routine. But anyway, but then she says, if you eat them, then you love me. See, this is my offering to you. It's a love offering to you. And if you reject my cinnamon rolls, you reject me. And so in my home, food and love were equated. And so when my wife isn't being very nice to me sometimes, where do I go? I go to the fridge because I want to go to something that is nice to me. You know, and my wife doesn't bake cinnamon rolls, but which I'm glad because I'd probably be a lot larger than what I am right now. Okay, so sometimes you can tie food equals love. In many homes, and that's basically, you know, that's a dysfunctional home when that's in fact the case, where love has to be, you know, tangibly shown in that particular way. One is for control. When all else is out of control, perhaps the only thing I can control is what I do or do not eat. I have control over that. But what's interesting is we talked about in eating disorders is that gets out of control pretty fast. And so something I do to control becomes out of control. One of the things. Success. One thing I can be successful at is being thin with an anorexic. And, you know, I shared the story about the gal who lost the 2 pounds. Another one is protection. It could be an emotional need for protection. Some individuals practice compulsive binging to gain weight to protect themselves from having relationships. Some do that. Now, you know, there was a young lady recalls a day in high school. As I was talking to her, she recalls a day in high school when she had this favorite teacher, and this favorite teacher made some inappropriate advances towards her after class one day when she'd stayed behind for some special project or something. And she was kissed on the lips. I mean, that was the extent of the advances. But she was an inexperienced, naive, which was good. You know, she did not know anything about sexual issues. She was normal body size and shape for her age and everything. I saw her 3 years later. She was between 75 to 100 pounds overweight. And what she had done, that had so scared her because of this you know, inappropriate advance that she had begun to stuff her face with food. And what happened is then her body went out this direction. And guess what? She didn't really have to worry that much about pressure from dating anymore. Guys were not hot on her trail pursuing her. And she liked it that way because she didn't know what to do if they would do that. She's not sure that she wanted that type of a thing. So some people can use it for protection. Okay? In the anorexic, they can attempt to control the natural bulges that occur during puberty. They may not understand that. They may not want to deal with relational sexual issues. And when their body starts growing in certain areas, they just stop eating, because maybe I can control the growing of my body. And so sometimes that's why it may come on at puberty. You know, they see a real correlation with that. And then finally, it's perfection. So if one thinks a particular body provision or food will meet an emotional need, they will be driven to try that provision more and more and more. So if I think a piece of pizza is going to meet my need for love and acceptance, and I eat one and it doesn't meet my need for love and acceptance, guess what my conclusion is? Eat another one. Now that doesn't make a lot of sense, but that's the way we work. So we eat another one. Well, that didn't work. Eat another one. That didn't work. Eat another one. And it just goes on, and that's kind of the cycle that a person begins to get into, because was never intended to meet that deep emotional need. Okay? Now, what's really interesting, and this will be the last thing, is that what I basically looked at is two-thirds. And, you know, most of you know where I do counseling with the BSU there in Norman, Oklahoma. And I've looked at body, and we've looked at basically personality, or which I call soul, mind, will, and emotions, comprising our personality. And so we see that a body need or body provision will not meet a soul desire for love or acceptance or whatever it is. But in the same way, a soul provision will not meet a spiritual desire. So many people looking for that perfect love and acceptance try to go to an individual to get their love and acceptance needs met, which can only be met in the spiritual. And that's a dead-end street too. And guess what they try? They try more relationship, a different relationship, more sex, more pornography, more whatever it is, to try to meet their deepest need for love and acceptance, which can only come in the spiritual. And so that's why I like to do what I do, is because I'm in a non-restrictive counseling setting. People on a university setting in general, like the counseling center here, are restricted counselors. They can only talk to you about body and soul. They can't talk to you about spirit. They can only talk about body and soul. And so that's why I enjoy my job, because I can take it one step further. And I'm beginning to see, I have seen, my training is in all three areas. Because I have a master's degree in nutrition, I've got my PhD in behavior science counseling, and I've got a lot of training in Christian counseling, or spiritual counseling, if you want to call it that. So I see it as really a correlation, a holistic counseling approach to it, as being the most effective approach. And there is a new book out, and you may be interested in it, but Rafa puts it out. And Rafa is a Greek name for healing. And it's basically, it works what's called the 12-step program. But it is a good, helpful, insightful book, regardless of whether you tie into the 12 steps or not. But it is a workbook to help someone with eating disorders, it's just on eating disorders, work through various physiological issues, mental and emotional issues, and spiritual issues. And I'll stop here and open it up for any questions or lunch, whichever comes first. Okay, questions or comments or testimonies or observations or yes.
Yeah, everybody that I know that has eating disorder they're getting into the protection reason that you talked about. You know, people don't find me attractive, I don't have to worry about it. Is that a common theme that they're doing it to protect themselves from society or other people?
I wouldn't necessarily say it's a common theme. It is a theme, but not necessarily a common theme. You know, with this, what I try to point out here is various different reasons, you know, why they do that. I don't run into that one too often, but you do run into it, you know, basically saying.
What is the name of the Robert workbook? Is that a Robert McGee
book? Correct. Matter of fact, I've got it in my briefcase, and you can see it and get the name and the thing afterwards. By the way, I do have a list. If you're interested, I have a list of support groups and here on campus and off campus that deal with this issue that you can begin referring people to, or get to become a part of. So remind me. I'll stick that out after class. Basically, you're available, you give them space, and you accept them for just the way they are. And they know, if you've breached it, they know that you're concerned, and they know that you kind of know what's going on. And they may try to withdraw and pull away, but you can kind of pursue them a little bit. But I would just be their friend. I mean, that would be the main thing, just to be their friend and basically hang in there. Don't become impatient with them and, you know, beat him over the head with a submarine sandwich or something. So, okay? Yeah?
If they're not willing to get help, and it's important to know that there's some serious health problems on the immediate horizon, do you recommend an interventionistic approach to them, or are you still waiting until they're willing to?
Yeah, there actually comes a point when they have to get hospitalized. I mean, that's really true. If they're, you know, you've got a choice. You can let them die, or you can, because some people get that bad. And so that's when you can take some responsibility at that point in getting them help. And see, I've only had to do that once. I've hospitalized one. And it was necessary because they would have killed themselves. I mean, it's essentially what would have happened. And so it's not a real common thing, but if you see someone going down deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, I would guess there comes a point when a bunch of friends get together. It's almost like an alcoholics confrontational, you know, group intervention type of a group. Say, listen, you have got a problem. And we're telling you this not to say shape up, but because we want to help.
Do you think that they should be on a unit that's specifically for eating disorders, or would you recommend going on to a general psych unit to deal with eating disorders?
Most of the people I know that have gone on general psych ones aren't real happy with it. I think they're a lot more comfortable with if there's a specific area. There's the book. If there's a specific one that's just designed for eating disorders, I think they can identify a lot more, and they're a lot more satisfied with the treatment. But that's the criticisms I've heard, is those who go into general psych ones, because you're working with a, you know, child abuser here and a, you know, some physical abuse thing here and this, you know, you're dealing with all those things, and there's sometimes not a lot of relation. You know, they people aren't relating to them, and there's a tendency, by the way, with the support groups. One of the interesting things about a support group is if you go to a support group thinking you're going to find a solution, you're going to be disappointed. Support groups are to help you understand, not to give you necessarily a solution. So you go to the support group and somebody says, well, I just feel such and such and so, and you go, yeah, that's exactly the way I feel. I never put it into words before, but that's exactly the way I feel. And that's what you learn in a support group, is that kind of stuff. By the way, there's a misnomer. There's a common belief out there that if I understand the problem, I can solve it. So all I have to do is understand it, then I can solve it. And you know what? I've never seen that yet. Well, I can understand the fact that I like to overeat, but I've got a master's degree in nutrition. I understand the problem perfectly well. But that doesn't solve my problem. Because it takes something beyond that.